and to look at her, Masid, Hamid, Shalalara, and the rest, but Chayda ignored them, focusing squarely on Ishaq.
"There's something I would show you, my sheikh," she said breathlessly. "Please."
Ishaq looked to the others.
"Very well, but it will have to wait until the morning."
"Tomorrow will be too late," Chayda said. "It must be now."
She motioned to Leora and Salsana, both burning orange under the brilliance of the western sky.
"Please."
Ishaq paused, working his mouth as he often seemed to do when he was annoyed.
"Very well."
Chayda led him away from the others, feeling their stares at her back. She ignored them and brought Ishaq toward the skiff, resting near the stern of Leora's ship. She motioned to Leora and Salsana as she went.
"Come."
Soon all four of them had boarded the skiff and were sailing out to the edge of the standing stones. When they stopped, most of the stones were behind them, leaving the desert to sprawl ahead of them. Chayda could not see Karim, but she could feel him sitting out there, cloaked in the gathering darkness.
"I know your mind, child of Ayanesh. Do not ask it of me. I cannot."
"We have no choice," she said to him. "Fate's willing, I'll be leaving soon and I cannot take you with me."
A stab of fear, a spark of sadness.
"You would abandon me?"
"Never. I will return, but I must leave you with the children of those who survived Bet Iman. Come, Karim, take Salsana's hand. Take the hand of the one you blooded."
Using the same tone, calm but forceful, Chayda turned to Salsana and said,
"I've brought you here to bond with Karim."
There was no hiding the look of repulsion and shock on Salsana's scarred face. Leora, however, seemed suddenly eager, and Ishaq was unreadable.
"Bond?"
The note of fear in Salsana's voice was plain.
"I will not bond with it."
"Do not call him it in my hearing again," Chayda said. "And yes, you must bond with him, that he may know you, and through you the others in our tribe."
Salsana looked between Leora and Ishaq, waiting for either to object. When neither did, she said,
"You cannot leave him."
"I cannot take him with me."
Chayda met Ishak's gaze.
"If I am to go by your leave and with your help, then Karim must remain here. You were right the other day. His presence anywhere near Sharakai will alert them to my presence. And it's long past time that we learn more about the Asirim and the Asirim, us."
Salsana looked as if she was about to speak, but she fell silent as Leora gripped her wrist. Ishaq's gaze drifted from Chayda to Leora to Salsana. His only response was to give one sharp nod, an acknowledgement that Chayda may try, and that Salsana should as well.
"Go on," Leora said. "Draw him near."
Salsana seemed unsure, even scared, while in the desert, Karim's anger flared.
"Nalame's grace," he said. "I bled for you."
"I bled for you as well, and would do so again gladly if my pain would set you free."
Doubt grew inside him like a cancer.
"I would die for your sake if you but take me back to Sharakai."
"It's too dangerous, Karim, for both of us."
His wail broke the still silence of the desert, driving a spear of ice through her heart.
"Please don't leave me," he begged.
She knew he would feel betrayed by her demand, but she hadn't understood the depths of it until now. After centuries with the other Asirim, souls who had suffered the same fate, he was terrified of being alone.
"Don't you see?" she said to him. "You won't be alone."
But Karim wasn't listening. He was drowning in his own emotions. She had to finish this quickly before he lost faith in her. She had to make him wake and see the others, or she'd be condemning him to death. She faced Salsana now. She might be willing to try for Ishak's sake, maybe even Leora's, but that wasn't enough. She had to believe or this would never work.
He can protect you, Jada said to her. Even as you protect him. For the first time since Bet Iman, he can heal.
Jada reached out to Karim, giving him the love for the family she had never known but had dreamt about since she was young.
Come to me, child of Deniz, cousin to Sahid Alaz. These people are your blood. Our tribe is reborn.
Reborn, Karim scoffed. Our tribe will be reborn only when the Asylum are freed and the kings have paid for their misdeeds. Then let me go, Jada replied. Let me do just that.
Her next words she spoke aloud, for they were meant for all of them. Karim, Salsana, Leora, and Ishak.
It won't be chains you forge this day, but bonds to one another's hearts. It will make us all stronger.
She took Salsana's hands in hers. Salsana, to Cheda's great relief, did nothing to stop her.
Let him heal. Let him see what life is like in your desert, the one so different from the one he's known. Let him hear the laugh of a child. Let him hear the songs written when he walked the earth a man, and those that have been written since. Let him remember his own joys, his own loves, even as you revel in yours.
Karim didn't want to return to Sharakai, not truly. He was only scared of Cheda's leaving, and Salsana, for her part, was a woman who deeply revered the 13th tribe. She simply had yet to recognize Karim as part of it. Both of them seemed to understand these things, for in that moment, Salsana's grip softened and Karim's reluctance began to melt.
Cheda's heart sang to see it,
but they were not yet done. She held out her hand to Leora, motioning to the locket around her neck.
A petal, Leora, if you please.
Leora's eyes flitted to Salsana as her hands went to her throat and opened the locket. From it she retrieved a petal, which glowed blue-white in the last light of sunset. She handed it to Cheda, and Cheda stood before Salsana.
Open your mouth.
Salsana did, and Cheda placed the petal beneath her tongue. Cheda's awareness of Salsana blossomed, as it no doubt did for Karim as well. Karim crept closer as Cheda, Leora, and Ishak stepped away, leaving Salsana to wait alone as Karim crawled from the darkness. His breath came in broken fragments, his body tilted sideways, as if he were moving against some unseen current. Tears streamed down Salsana's face as she fell to her knees and held out her hand. Karim came nearer, but it seemed a bridge too far to take her hand. Like a man lost and weary after days in the desert, he collapsed against the sand and clutched himself. Salsana touched his shoulder, then knelt by his side, and pulled him up until she was embracing him. For all the world, she looked like a mother consoling a child who had grown fearful of the night. Cheda felt her own bond with Karim slipping away. His thoughts became muted, his emotions dimmed. Soon he was little more than a distant presence, a figure in the fog. Taking both Leora's and Ishak's hands, Cheda moved farther away, leaving the two of them in peace. When they reached the skiff, Cheda turned to Ishak.
You let my mother go when it was her will to journey to Sharakai and carry out a mission she believed in. I am the result of that decision. Your decision, grandfather. Everything your daughter did led to me, to this day. Everything she did is pointing me back toward Sharakai. I would go, but I would have your blessing before I do,
To her surprise, Ishak, this legend of the desert, a man who seemed made of stone, seemed unsure of himself. He swallowed. He looked to Leora and then the scene that was playing out between Salsana and Karim.
"We've only just met."
There were tears in his eyes.
"I know," Chayda said, "and we'll meet again."
She took his hands in hers and kissed both his cheeks.
"If the fates are kind, we'll meet again."
He looked at her as though she were a lovable fool.
"The fates are not kind."
"No, but they cannot be this cruel."
Lifting his hands and gripping her head, Ishak kissed her cheeks.
"Go to Sharakai, granddaughter. See if the Asirim can be freed. See if the maidens can be turned. Find the truth of my daughter's journey the night before she died. You'll do this for me?"
"I will."
Chayda's tears flowed freely now. She released Ishak's hands and took a deep breath, wiping her eyes with the palms of her hands.
"I have one last request."
She removed Misut's bracelet from her left hand and held it out to Leora.
"Take this. Become its guardian until I return. Learn whatever you can about it, for there are more here we must care for."
Leora looked scared to touch it. But then she reached out both hands and took it in hers. Slipping the bracelet over her wrist, she looked at Chayda with wonder in her eyes.
"By Nalame's grace, child."
"What?"
Chayda said, feeling suddenly uncomfortable.
"When Aya left for Sharakai, she went to make a child with one of the kings. We dreamed of that child becoming a weapon, being their ruin. But if Aya could see you now, she would see you are no weapon, but a mirror through which we can see our very soul."
"I'm no such thing."
"Ah."
Leora waddled forward and took Chayda into an embrace.
"But that's the thing about mirrors. They're unable to witness their own reflections."
Chapter 25. The following morning, many of the Kianat ships were taking to the wind. All flew new pennants atop their main masts, a white mountain on a blue field.
"Toriat?"
Chayda asked Dadzada, though the shape of the mountain wasn't quite right.
"No,"
he replied gruffly.
"It's Arizal."
"Why Mount Arizal?"
Arizal was the source of the aqueduct that fed Sharakai's reservoirs, and so was viewed as a giver of life in the city. Knowing Ishak, however, a man who prized symbolism, there would be more to it than that.
"After Betty Mum, the surviving members of our tribe fled to a valley beneath that peak. They used to meet there in the depths of summer. For a time, they thought themselves safe, but days later they were set upon by the Asirim."
Dadzada's perpetual frown deepened.
"Few escaped the slaughter."
Chayda stared at the pennants as the ships sailed farther away, feeling renewed anger at the kings, but also a rekindling of pride. How fragile those days must have been, and yet some few escaped to carry their story through the pages of time. As the ships dwindled in the distance, Chayda marveled at what Ishak had managed to accomplish. Even as the kings had stepped up their attacks in Sharakai, Ishak had faced a coup from within. Khamsakia, using guile or blood magic or both, had siphoned off support from those who had provided Ishak with not only the coin he needed to wage his war against the kings, but also the supplies, skill, and labor. But Ishak had not been idle in the years leading up to that struggle. He had foreseen trouble, even if he hadn't known what form it would take. He secreted away dozens of ships in desert caches, each of which had been loaded with essential supplies. Those ships were now being used to draw the tribe together and sustain them as more came out of hiding. Slowly but surely, the tribe was finding its footing. Later in the day, Chayda was preparing the skiff Salsana had used to rescue her and Karim from the tower. She had said her farewells to Ishak, Masid, Leora, and Salsana. She had yet to visit Emre, however, or Dadzada. But lo and behold, as she hoisted the last jug of water over the side, she saw Dadzada approaching with a bag over his shoulder. The sand shifted beneath his feet, giving him an odd gait. He looked like a bloody heron out of water. In a strange bit of timing, Emre emerged from Ishak's tent and began following him. And right behind Emre came the huge man they called Frail Lamai, who had a vaguely worried, almost puppy-like look on his face. When Emre noticed him, he stopped and raised his hands. Chayda couldn't hear what he was saying, but when he was done, Frail Lamai nodded and remained where he was, watching as Emre quickened his pace, so that by the time Dadzada reached the skiff, Emre was right there beside him. For a moment, the three of them were awkward as mismatched teacups. Emre and Dadzada simply stared at Chayda, or more to the point, were pointedly not staring at one another. Last night, after agreeing to her request, Ishak had promised to send someone with her. She knew she needed the help, but...
Goshen's pendulous balls, you're not both coming with me, are you?
Emre looked sidelong at Dadzada. Dadzada laughed that deep, biting laugh of his, the one Emre used to hate so much. If the look on Emre's face was any indicator, time had done nothing to temper the feeling.
You think Ishak would let someone like Emre accompany you?
Chayda stared at him.
So you're to join me?
Does that present a problem?
Chayda shifted uncomfortably.
I don't...
Breath of the desert, girl, spit it out!
The journey will be taxing, Chayda said. Wouldn't you rather...
Don't waste your breath, Dadzada broke in. Believe me, I'd let you go on this fool mission alone, but Ishak has ordered it. So I'm going.
With that, he hoisted the bag over the side of the skiff and stared at her, as if he expected her to set sail and leave on the spot.
He'll be a chain around my ankles.
But what could she do about it now? She should have pressed Ishak last night. She might have argued against Dadzada then, but not now, not with the entire camp already packing up to sail. She turned to Emre.
And you?
He waved at a distant cutter.
I'm leaving today on the mission to Tribe Kadri, to see if we can stop Sheikh Mihir from joining hands with Anur. Time grows short, Dadzada said, his hand on the gunwale.
No, it doesn't, Chayda snapped. Wait.
She led Emre away, with Dadzada watching her and Frail Lamai watching Emre. She couldn't help it. It felt so awkward that a laugh burst from her.
Stop it, Chayda.
He looked hurt.
These are dangerous days.
Yes, but for the first time since my mother died, I feel hopeful, Emre.
He seemed to lighten at that.
Hopeful.
He said it with furrowed brow, then gave her that unbalanced smile of his.
I just hope the Blade Maidens don't string you up too high.
I hope Anur doesn't crush you like a rattlewing.
He'll have to catch me first. By the time he's lumbered after me, I'll have stuck him 3 times on that fat ass of his with his own spear.
Chayda laughed as she stepped in and embraced him, taking care not to put pressure on his still tender ribs.
Take care, Emre.
And you.
As he headed back toward camp, she kicked a massive spray of sand over his back. She turned, mouth agape, as he shook the sand from his hair and his clothes. He laughed and kicked sand back at her. But Chayda was already skipping away and escaped the confrontation unscathed. Both chuckling, they went their separate ways. Near the skiff, Dardzada rolled his eyes.
Ishak said you hope to find the silver trove,
Dardzada said the first night of their voyage. He was sitting on a stone, paring the skin off a juicy cactus leaf. The yellow-green peelings fell to the sand between his feet.
Or at least learn more about it.
Chayda sat across from him, a fire crackling softly between them.
I think your instincts were right. I think my mother believed in the trove, and I think she went to find it.
Dardzada shrugged.
My instincts also tell me it was a trap. Are you going to believe that part, too?
I'm not discounting it, but I want to know more about what happened to her that night. I want to retrace her steps before going to the House of Maidens.
You don't know where her path led her.
I think I do.
She pulled Aya's letter from her pouch and handed it to Dardzada. As he read it by the firelight, she continued,
When I came to you in your apothecary, you said she'd found a mirage.
Finishing the letter, Dardzada stared into the fire, perhaps lost in memories.
She told me she'd gone to find it in the whispers, but that she found only a mirage.
She motioned to the letter, and there it said she was preparing to go to the mount, and that she hoped to uncover more treasures. I think the silver trove might not be silver at all. I think it might be the poems recited on Toriat. The silver might refer to Tulathan herself.
Dardzada's body drew inward while his face soured. It was what he did while worrying at a problem.
Tulathan.
Yes, and if it's true, then I want to begin my search there at the site of the ritual.
If it's true.
Yes, if, but it makes sense. It would explain why my mother risked so much to go there. It might also explain why she returned as she did, perhaps under the command of King Isan.
She paused a moment.
I want to go there on Bet Jair.
To her surprise, Dardzada didn't immediately try to deny her.
Why not the night before, as your mother did?
It's likely I won't have this chance again, and whatever the kings are trying to hide is because of Bet Jair, so I think it's best if I go then, don't you?
He slid the knife over the cactus with a practiced hand. As a peel flew into the fire and sizzled, he shrugged his stocky shoulders.
I suppose if it was a trap, it's likely been sprung. I can't imagine the kings will be sitting there every night waiting for someone to show up. But you're forgetting one rather important thing.
What?
You don't know where the ritual was held.
I do know. I've seen it, Dardzada. That day at your apothecary, when I fought Mesid, I was overwhelmed by the Aesir Hava, and I saw the gods standing on a plateau near the very top of the mountain.
She could hardly hold her gaze. When she spoke again, his words were tentative but caring, the sort a parent might use after finally deciding to give a child more freedom.
You'll be able to find it by moonlight.
I am certain of it.
Dardzada became fixated by the fire.
You'll take care.
Of course, as much as I'm able.
He blinked and drew breath sharply through his nostrils.
Very well, then.
Jada's lips curled into a smile as she set about the business of boiling water for rice.
Dardzada, did you just agree with me?
He shrugged as another peel flew.
It's important what you're doing. I see no reason not to find out one way or another if you're right.
He rushed on before she could say anything to embarrass him.
What about the Aesirim?
That's a bit trickier. Unless the kings work actively against me, I'm certain I can bond with several Aesirim, perhaps as many as 5 or 6. I might even be able to draw them into the desert. The pressure on Kerim diminished the further he got from the blooming fields.
Dardzada lifted his head,
his knife held steady.
You could maintain such a bond for months?
Perhaps.
Even so, the pressure on Karim, as you call it, was hardly minimal.
Granted, it will likely prevent us from unleashing them against Sharakai directly. But it may be enough to keep them by our side far out in the desert. They could help to protect us as we rebuild, and we could learn, hopefully find a way to free them.
Still, 5 or 6.
He picked up another cactus leaf, the last for their meal, and set to peeling it.
It's hardly inspiring.
I know. The permanent solution may only be found when the kings are dead. But there might be another way. Sahid Alaz. I think there is a bond between him and the other Asirim. Dadzada considered.
You mean all the other Asirim?
Yes.
You think he's still alive?
I'm certain of it. Through Karim, I felt him. Though the link to him was thin as spider silk. It's another reason I want to speak with more of the Asirim. If we can learn more, and if we can find Sahid Alaz and take him with us, speak to him, we may find a way.
It's a lot to do, Cheddar.
Done peeling, he began cutting long, thick slices off the white, edible cactus leaf. He handed one to Cheddar. She took a large bite. The mildly sweet meat crunched in her mouth like a juicy melon. Bet Jair was less than a week away. She would try to find the trove that night, and on her way out, steal into the House of Maidens to speak to Melis. If all went well, she and Dadzada might be able to travel to the Blooming Fields and bond with some of the Asirim. It would be a good night to do it, she reckoned. Their anger was upon them then, and they might be better able to use it to throw off their yokes. Don't worry, she told Dadzada. I'm not setting my sights too high. My only hope for Sahid Alaz is to locate him. We can make plans to return another time and free him. As they ate their simple meal, passing a water skin back and forth, Dadzada frowned. He opened his mouth, stopped, and then said,
How will you get into the House of Kings?
She had the impression that wasn't what he had been about to say, but she let it go.
Through the tunnels.
Dadzada nodded, lost in thought.
Is there an apothecary in the city we can trust?
She asked, partly to gauge his reaction. He turned sharply toward her, his face a mixture of feigned and genuine shock.
What am I, minced goat?
Cheddar laughed. Components, Dadzada.
We need components so you can make me something. Is there someone you can trust?
The firelight played over his round features as he considered.
Make you something? What does that mean?
She began to catalogue what she would need to get into the House of Maidens, and out again as well, especially if things turned bad. But she could tell that Dadzada was only half listening. She stopped halfway through and waited for him to take notice of her.
What is it you're not saying?
Sahid Alaz. You seem to think that freeing him will somehow free the other Asirim.
I said that it could lead to freeing them.
Yes, well, you also said that you thought the Asirim might not be freed until the kings lay dead.
Yes.
Have you not considered that for the Asirim to be freed, Sahid Alaz himself might have to die?
She wanted to laugh, but the dead, serious look on his face prevented it. Her mind wandered to all she knew about the king of the 13th tribe. He was taken like the other Asirim, but there had been a power in him unlike the others. Over the centuries he had found a way around the spell of silence the gods placed on him. He'd spoken to those with blood of the 13th tribe, hoping that one of them might find a way to kill King Mesut.
He'd stood against the kings on the night of endless swords. He had disobeyed their commands. Any other Asirim would have been killed. Why not Sahid Alaz? Why would the kings show restraint? Why not kill him and be done with the problems he presented? Chayda's bowl lowered into her lap as a terrible shiver ran down her frame. Oh, God. The poem. The one she had heard from Sahid Alaz's own mouth. How could she have forgotten? Rest will he, neath twisted tree, till death by Sion's hand. By Nalame's tears and godly fears shall kindred reach dark land. She recited it aloud. Dadzada remained silent after, his eyes sparkling in the firelight, his body still as stone. The realization was beginning to settle in him. The same as it had for her. The realization that after all the king of the 13th tribe had done for her, she may have to kill him to free the rest. Chapter 26. Emre watched the skiff sail away, Dadzada sitting at the tiller, Chayda working the sail.
You like her, Emre?
Frail Lamai asked as he trudged up behind him.
Sure I like her.
Frail Lamai pursed his lips as he considered the skiff's dwindling form.
Should have told her then.
You're probably right.
I know I'm right. She'd be good for you.
Doesn't mean I'd be good for her.
Nah. You would.
With a nod, as if he had never been more sure of anything in his life, he pulled Emre in and kissed the top of his head, much like Frail Lamai's waif of a mother did to her massive son each time he left her home.
You would!
A whistle made them both turn. Beyond many of the largest standing stones, Hamid was waving to them from the deck of a small cutter. Masid stood behind him, barking orders as the ship prepared to set sail.
Time to go, Lem!
Time to go!
Soon they were off, a small delegation sailing east on the cutter Drifting Sun. They passed beyond the standing stones and over open sand as the bulk of the tribe's ship turned south. Several times a day, Masid's nephew, a skinny boy with closely shorn hair and big ears, would send up a falcon, a gorgeous bird of mottled brown with a tan belly and auburn markings behind its eyes.
Looks like it's painted for war,
Emre said jokingly to him one day.
It is,
the boy shot back, his face stone serious. He caught Emre's wry smile and went on.
Thash himself kissed the egg that hatched him.
When Emre laughed, the boy glowered and launched the falcon into the air. The bird ranged far ahead, travelling in a vast arc ahead of the ship. When it returned hours later, it would alight on the boy's outstretched arm, which was protected by a double-thick glove. The falcon would get a vole for its trouble, and no small amount of petting along its crest feathers, before a leather hood was placed back on its head, and it was returned to its wicker cage near the pilot's wheel. On the fourth day, as the falcon was flying a few points off the starboard bow, it began to circle.
Ship's hull!
The boy called, pointing to the falcon. Masid ordered the ships to adjust course. As the sun sailed closer, the falcon's lazy circles brought it progressively lower, until it executed a pinwheel turn and dove straight for their ship. One moment it was flying like a spear toward his handler, and the next its wings were wide and its talons were extended. It landed on the boy's arm triumphant, where it received not one vole, but two, and was allowed to rest in its cage for a time without its hood.
Come!
Masid called a short while later, waving Emre and Hamid toward the foredeck.
The three of them joined Shalalara, who stood at the bow. Soon enough, they spotted the masts of several dozen ships. Maseed, the wind tugging at the twin tails of his pepper-flecked beard, placed one sandaled foot on the gunwales and stretched.
Anor has two tribes under his yoke already, and unless we can convince Tribe Kadri otherwise, he'll soon have another.
He pointed to the ships ahead.
We will speak with her sheikh, Mihir Halamava, who sent one of his tribe's elders to treat with Anor. He hopes that in approaching Anor, he'll be able to ensure a favored place for his tribe in the fight against Sharakai.
Shalalara hawked and spat over the side of the ship.
Blood traitors, she said, Mihir included.
Her turban, a rich eggplant color with flecks of gold, was wrapped in the desert's western style, unbalanced and low enough on one side that it covered her right ear. Combined with the tattoo of a ram's skull that spanned her forehead, it deepened an already rakish look. Emre guessed she was younger than Maseed by 5 years, and perhaps 10 years Emre's senior, but her attitude and the way she looked at Emre from time to time, as if she'd make a meal of him given half the chance, made her seem younger.
That remains to be seen, Maseed said. Until we know more, leave such thoughts unspoken.
The wind made the sleeves and skirt of Shalalala's white abaya ripple like wind-blown silk.
The man would clasp hands with a king! Mihir has no love for the kings. He lost his mother to their cruelty and saw his father pass to the farther fields while kneeling to them. And now he would do the same. Better to die with sword in hand than kiss the feet of your enemy. He's practical, Maseed replied easily. He sees Anor as a tool he might use to stab at the heart of Sharakai. And if Anor's quest to conquer Sharakai is lost, then Mihir still wins. The kings are weakened and he slips back into the desert with his tribe.
Hamid sat easily on the gunwales opposite Maseed. Since their terrible row after Ardson's death, Hamid had been quiet around Maseed, but now he seemed anxious, almost angry.
What in the great, wide desert are we doing? He's not going to change his mind. He's already reached out to Anor.
Maseed shrugged.
Mihir wants two things, revenge for his mother and father and to protect his people. If we can give him both those things and show that Anor can't, he'll join us. And if he doesn't?
Emre asked. Maseed smiled, a broad thing that revealed how confident he was of the coming meeting.
Then we will remind him of his heritage.
He would explain no further, and soon they were nearing the Kadri ships, which had formed a large circular enclosure across the dunes. A sand-coloured pennant was hoisted atop the drifting sun's main mast, a signal for truce and parley. As the drifting sun's skies sighed to a halt, several dozen warriors wearing orange and yellow thorbs and brown turbans and veils met them. Maseed headed for the gangway.
Shalalara and Emre with me. Hamid, ensure the safety of the ship. If things turn bad, you'll take word to my father, so keep her ready to sail.
Hamid, who had begun to follow Maseed, came to a stuttering halt. He stared at Maseed's back, then at Emre with that stony, nearly emotionless look of his. Emre had seen it a dozen times before, the sort of cold calculation that came from being slighted, which Hamid would stew over for days, even months before his anger came back in one violent rush. Emre shrugged.
I can watch the ship, Maseed. You already have orders, young falcon,
Maseed shot over his shoulder. And so Emre left, trailing after Maseed and Shalalara through the gap in the line of warriors who watched them warily, though thankfully with no great enmity. They were led to a ship on the far edge of the circle, where a pavilion and several tents had been erected. A young man, no older than Emre, came out to meet them. His hands were raised, his palms toward them, revealing the complex orange tattoos there. It was a sign of peace, a gesture. Masid returned, and the two of them embraced.
"Well met, Mehir,"
Masid said, slapping his back affectionately.
"And you?"
Mehir replied, doing the same. He was a handsome man with dark skin and dark eyes and a wide smile, all of which accented his rust-colored thawb and thread-of-gold turban.
"And you brought friends?"
He clasped his hands and bowed to Emre and Shalalara.
"You're welcome to share our fires and our bread. As long as we've brought a bit of arak?"
Masid asked, pulling an oval-shaped bottle from the bag at his side.
"Certainly doesn't hurt,"
Mahir said, accepting it.
"Baki's bright smile, you've brought me a bottle of Tulakal,"
Masid laughed.
"Though the Great Mother was parched and tried to drink of it many times, yes. In that case, we'll all partake."
He swung the bottle in a beckoning motion, a simple but welcoming gesture that somehow encapsulated Masid, Emre, and Shalalara.
"Please, honor me. The honor is ours."
Mihir led them to the pavilion, which sat in the lee of the largest and sleekest of the ships. A dozen older children, guided by a doddering matron, were busying themselves, bringing pillows to lay about the carpeted floor, laying out dates and olives and cups of water, plus empty blue glasses for the rare arak. Mehir introduced his wife and his brother, and many more besides, the elders of Tribe Kadri. But Emre's eyes kept drifting to one particular woman, a Malasani who was conspicuous among the desert folk. She wore silk trousers so baggy they could easily be confused with a skirt, an embroidered white shirt made of some rich, supple fabric, and a red, brocaded waistcoat. The necklace of 1,000 coins around her neck accented her headdress, which was large and ornate, and had many more tiny coins and chains hanging from it. They glinted in the sun, sneaking through the pavilion's thin cloth roof. And yet none of that was what made her stand out. It was her eyes. They were dark, demanding. She was royalty of some sort, Emre had no doubt, the sort who confused covetous thoughts with ownership. 3 steps behind her was a man as rotund as Emre had ever seen. He was shorter than Emre, but probably outweighed frail Lamai by 3 stone. He had hulking arms crossed over his broad chest, and by his side carried a huge curving scimitar with metal rings worked in along the blunt edge. They made a shink sound as he shifted to face Emre. The way he stared, a stone-like scowl while the sun shone off his bald pate, was so comical Emre nearly laughed. Mihir waved to the pillows and most sat. Emre, however, remained standing. He scanned the desert beyond the ring of Kadri ships and spotted another beyond its edge. A Malasani Dao.
"I see no need for a Malasani spy to sit with us."
The conversation, which had been lively up to this point, came to a complete and immediate halt. Masid, who had already sat on Emre's right, gave him a look, but Emre didn't care.
He'd be damned before he sat with the Malasani, especially with the future of the 13th tribe hanging in the balance.
"I am Hadad," she said before anyone else could reply. "A caravan master. An ally to Tribe Kadri. I could be an ally to Tribe Kianat as well."
"You are an interloper," Emre shot back. "Not worthy of a seat at this council."
Unperturbed, she sat cross-legged on one of the pillows nearest to Mihir, took a clutch of grapes from a nearby bowl, plucked one and crunched on it loudly.
She is an honored guest, said Mihir, who had remained standing.
As were you, until now. Sit, young one, before you embarrass your lord further.
When Masid motioned for Shalalara to sit, she took her seat with the same sort of leisure as Haddad. Masid took Emre by the elbow and whispered,
Control yourself. Why do you think you are here and not Hamid?
He waved to the space on his left with a look that made it clear Emre would be playing with fire if he disobeyed the order. Doing his best to ignore Haddad's satisfied smile, Emre complied. Masid's words had been like a bucket of cold water. Hamid had a terrible, cruel streak in him, a thing Emre had always been somewhat afraid of. Was that how he, Emre, now seemed to Masid? To Mihir? They ate for a time and spoke of sailing in the desert, of hunting in the mountain reaches. A song, one of Tribe Kadri's oldest, was sung by a young girl with a magical voice. As promised, Mihir shared the arrak with everyone gathered. Emre was sure it was exquisite, but it tasted sour on his tongue. At last they came to business.
I've come at my father's behest, Masid said. We've come to ask that you join us as we raise our spears against the kings.
The implication was clear.
Onur was a king, not to mention a growing threat in the eastern reaches of the great Shangazi. Your ships are few, Mihir said, as are your spears. We have enough, Masid said, and our numbers continue to grow as more heed our call. You have enough to stand against Charakai? Enough to stop the silver spears, their maidens, the Asirim? My good sheikh, there is but one king who stands before us.
Mihir set his glass down on the low table between them with a clack.
Fine, then. You think you can stop Onur? Not on our own, but if we stand together, yes.
Haddad laughed, the coins on her headdress clinking.
Did I not tell you? I said they would come begging favors while foolish tales spilled from their mouths.
Mihir raised a hand.
Onur wishes to pit himself against Charakai. We'd be fools not to allow it. If we fight him now, we only weaken ourselves. Join us, Masid. Join us, that we might tear down the walls of Charakai. You don't know what you're asking. For 400 years have we been hunted. For 400 years have we hidden in the cracks of the desert.
Like cowards,
Haddad interjected. At this, Masid stopped. He swiveled his head to Haddad.
Mihir, Sheikh of Tribe Kadri, you have allowed this woman to sit beside us. You said her counsel has value, and I'll not deny you any of that. But if she speaks ill of my tribe again, I'll cut her tongue from her mouth and throw it at your feet.
The hulk of a swordsman behind Haddad lumbered forward, his trunk of an arm reaching for his sword. The rings along the top of his scimitar sounded like rattling chains as he made to draw it, but when Haddad raised her hand, he stopped in his tracks. The rest of Tribe Kadri bristled, until Mihir raised both hands high, showing his tattoos once more.
Peace, he said, peace.
And slowly those assembled went silent.
I have a duty to my tribe, he went on, focusing intently on Masid, to protect them, to see them safe through the storm. Then fight. We'll gather more of our cause before the kings come.
He waved to Haddad.
And before Malasan can cross our borders like hungry wolves. Join us, and we will cut from the desert the cancer that is Onur before it grows.
When Mihir spoke again, his voice held some measure of regret.
I'm afraid it's too late. The emissary I sent to Onur returned last night. The king has agreed to my terms.
An agreement with the King of Sloth means nothing,
Masid shot back.
Have you not heard of his atrocities? His appetites are obscene. He feasts upon the flesh of man.
These, Haddad said, leaning toward Mihir, are but stories, nothing more, Sheikh.
Mihir nodded. They do seem far-fetched. Nothing is too cruel for the kings of Sharakai. You speak of cruelty. Of course they are cruel. But I would use that cruelty against them.
Mihir paused, as if debating how much to share.
I have made overtures to the other sheikhs for years, but everywhere I was denied. If all came together, some said, then perhaps...
This is precisely my point, Masid said. Join us, and together we will convince them.
When Mihir threw his head back and laughed, Emre saw Masid's calm exterior crack for the first time. His face reddened slightly, and his jaw worked for a moment before he calmed himself.
You have only just begun to gather, Mihir said. When the kings learn of it, and surely they already have, they will order the sheikhs to put a stop to it. You'll lose the support you need. There will be nowhere in the desert for you to hide, and then the kings will come for you while the blood mage Khamzakir picks at your bones.
He stared at Masid sadly.
Come. You know this to be true. The 13th tribe will stand against any who would deny us our right to live.
Mihir pressed his hands together and touched them to his lips in prayer.
I beg you. Open your eyes and see the truth. Onur is drawing the king's attention away from you, but it will not last forever.
He poured a fresh glass of arak for both himself and Masid, and then downed his in one throw.
Join us,
he said, baring his teeth from the alcohol burn.
Let us use Onur. Let us drive him like a wedge between the other kings. When the other sheikhs see what we have done, they'll rally to our cause. Soon the whole of the desert will come together under our banners, and then we can do as we please with the feasting king.
Masid nodded, as if he were considering Mihir's words, and then said,
400 years ago, Onur stood on the mount in Sharakai and gave his assent to the sacrifice of my people. He watched as they were enslaved by the power of the gods. He used them to hunt those of us who survived, to murder for the crime of allowing our name to pass their lips. He tried to wipe us from the face of the desert. And you would sit here and ask me to fight for him?
Like a candle in the rain, the hope in Mihir's eyes faded.
I had hoped we could do great things together.
Masid nodded grimly.
As had I.
Well,
with a sudden inhalation, Mihir took in the camp and ships around him.
There are preparations to make before we sail. I have one last request. We have no right to ask, but there are some few of our tribe hidden on Onur's camp. We've not heard from them in some time. My father would consider himself in your debt if you would allow two of our number to join you to learn of their fate.
Mihir looked ready to deny the request, but then he paused and looked at Emre, then Shalalara, then the drifting sun behind them. His look turned to one of grudging sympathy.
Give us one of the skiffs from your ship. Two may come, as long as they promise to abide by my wishes and leave as soon as the fate of your brothers and sisters is learned.
Masid refilled Mihir's glass, then took up his own. The two of them raised their glasses, then downed the lot. They stood and hugged, a gesture marked by much less enthusiasm than their earlier embrace, and the camp began breaking down around them. Masid led them back toward their ships. As the crew were lowering one of the skiffs, he pulled Emre aside. He reached into his thorb and pulled out an ornate kenshar.
"I have another task for you,"
he said, and held the kenshar for Emre to take. Emre accepted it.
"What's this?"
"The knife of Mihir's brother, Anish."
"Oh?"
Emre tipped his head back toward the Kadri ships.
"I assume there's a reason you didn't give it to him just now."
"There is," Masid said.
"Here's what I need you to do."
Chapter 27. Davood had no contact with Sukru in the days following his vision in the blooming fields. He couldn't shake the feeling that the strange cavern was a secret the kings wouldn't have chosen to share. But what could he do? He filled his days with reading, but never in his apartments so as to avoid Anila. He had asked for and been granted another room to read in. It was high in one of the palace's towers, with a stunning view through the lone window that overlooked the green estates of Sharakai's rich east end. The texts Sukru supplied him with were mostly useless with respect to Davood's current needs. Nearly all had been written by historians of a sort, or masters from the Collegia who had collected stories about blood magi over the ages. The most useful book was the very first one Sukru had given him. He realized when he came back to it a few days later, however, that a page was missing. He couldn't recall what it contained, but he remembered how intensely Anila had been studying the book, so he returned to their shared room to speak to her. When he arrived, however, Anila's things were gone. The spindly young chambermaid, the one who had been at the wading pool with Bella, was sweeping the floor around Anila's bed. She was crying, Davood realized.
"Whatever is the matter?"
he asked, wondering if something had happened to Anila.
"I'm sorry, my lord. It's little Bella."
She waved toward the door, her other hand to her mouth while tears streamed from her eyes.
"What happened to her?"
"She was sliding down the banisters from the great hall when she slipped and struck her head on the floor."
The maid shrugged, as if to say it is the will of the fates.
"Xander found her this morning. Already gone."
"Gods! My tears for your loss."
She looked so forlorn that he embraced her.
"Truly, she was a bright child."
She cried, and Davood let her until she pulled away, sniffing loudly and wiping her tears with the backs of her fingers.
"Forgive my ill manners," Davood said, "but I need to speak with Anila. Do you know where she's gone?"
"She was given another room in the palace, my lord."
"Where?"
"Just this morning."
"I said, where?"
She shook her head, as if clearing it of cobwebs.
"Forgive me, my lord. I'm no good today. I take you there, if you please."
Davood nodded, waving her toward the door. He felt hard-hearted for doing so, but talking to Anila couldn't wait. She led him to another wing of the palace, where they came to a door with an iron knocker. As she bowed and walked away, Davood knocked. From within the room, he heard a fluttering sound, like the pages of a book being flipped through quickly. When there was no answer, he tried again, and heard shuffling footsteps soon after. Anila opened the door wearing a flowing purple dress. She'd tied a red scarf around her head to cover her baldness. There were still bandages around her hands and wrists, and one on her right foot, but those around her face and neck had been removed. Her black skin shone, the patterns within it vivid in some places, muted in others. Anila made no move to invite him in.
What do you want?
I...